Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Patrick and get a free phone. Go to charitymobile.com.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Good morning. Welcome to the Patrick Madrid Show. And yes, I do believe it is Taco Tuesday, so we will be celebrating accordingly, including Taco Tuesday music. Right, Cyrus? We have it on tap today, right?
Yeah, when I don't play Taco Tuesday music, I get in trouble for it.
Not for me.
Not from you, no. I hear it from... There's some folks out there. They want like, their songs.
They're pounding their fists on the table. Where is the Taco Tuesday? Well, we'll get it for you. Coming up. 888-914-9149. You remember Elizabeth Warren, Cyrus, right? Senator Elizabeth Warren. She's a Democrat from Massachusetts.
Is she the Native American one?
Well, like, there's controversy surrounding that.
Okay. Yeah,
she's
yeah.
Made claims.
I think it's the same one.
Yeah, I think so. She's made claims to that effect, but that's been disputed by Native Americans. But in any case, this is not about that. She told the Washington Post, of an article here from the Daily Caller, she told the Washington Post that we should start building Planned Parenthood clinics in national parks. So like if you go, you know, you want to go with your kids. So you pack up your wife, your kids, get in the minivan, picnic lunch.
We're going to Frisbee. The Grand Canyon.
Yeah, so, you know, there or wherever.
Wherever.
You know, Jellystone Park. And you pack up the wife and the kids and the checkered blanket and the picnic lunch and the Frisbee, and it's going to be great. And, oh, and by the way, while you're there, you can also get an abortion. That's what she has in mind.
What?
And she said it with a straight face. She said they could put up tents and have trained personnel and be there to help people who need it. It's time to declare a medical emergency, she said. This isn't the first time, according to the Daily Caller, that she has called for the use of federal lands for abortion clinics. On ABC recently, she said, we should ask the President of the United States to make abortion as available as possible with the tools he has, including medication abortion, including using federal lands as a place where abortions can occur. So that, of course, would supersede state laws. So federal lands in Texas, for example, sounds like that's what she has in mind.
Sounds like this is an unfunny Onion article.
It does sound that way, doesn't it? But you're right, it is not funny, but they are deadly serious. And they're actually calling for the Department of Justice. This is a letter that she co-published in the New York Times, an op-ed, saying that the Department of Justice and all relevant agencies could analyze the types of reproductive health services that could be provided on federal property. Now, a whole bunch of senators are going along with this. Kirsten Gillibrand, Dianne Feinstein, Bernie Sanders. Not to be, I mean, it's not surprising that they would say the same thing. But there's a gathering head of steam here of lawmakers who want to circumvent the overthrow of Roe versus Wade and set up these pop-up abortion clinics in federal parks. So,
okie dokie.
Who knows? Yeah, who knows what may happen? They're just not going to let go of it. And I've said for a long time, I'm not the only one, of course. I don't claim to be the only one. But as I've said for many years, it's all about abortion. It makes you wonder, why can't they just live with reality? Why can't they just, you know, abide by law and the rule of law? They're going by hook or crook to get what they want, or at least they think they will. Now, meantime, in Spain, some good news. I'm really happy about this. This is from Catholic World Report, reporting that more than 100,000 people turned out yesterday for Spain's March for Life. This is in the capital city of Madrid, where I have spent some very pleasant days. They're protesting to propose changes to that country's abortion law and other bills that violate human dignity. According to the article, the pro-life institutions, and they give various names of them, organized the march and included more than 200 civil society organizations. The march started at the Bilbao roundabout and ended at Plaza Colón. They say words differently over there. And they're doing it. They're taking it to the streets, as the Doobie Brothers would say. I'm sure the Doobies are very happy about that. Nayeli Rodriguez, national coordinator for the 40 Days for Life campaign in Spain, representing more than 200 organizations that joined together for the march, noted that more than 2.5 million abortions have been performed in Spain since the abortion law went into effect in 1985. So about 12 years after ours did. And their point is you cannot decide who lives and who dies or push a society to do so because every life matters. Now, I concur, of course. You don't have a right to take the life of an innocent person. This, by the way, Cyrus, is why I was pointing out, I mentioned it on Twitter, that there were no rights lost last Friday when Roe versus Wade was overturned. How I love the sound of those words. When Roe versus Wade was overturned, it just flows off the tongue, doesn't it? Yes. When Roe, that day, not that long ago, when Roe versus Wade was overturned, yeah, people were saying, well, you're taking away women's rights. No, you're not, because you don't have a right to kill an innocent person. I'm waiting for the full stop lady to come in. Where is she? You know, let me start over. I'm going to set it up for you, Cyrus. No one has a right to take the life of an innocent person.
Full stop.
Oh, please.
I lost her. I don't know where she went. I think I replaced her with the harp.
What? I need the full stop lady.
I'll get her back.
I need her. All right,
I'll do it for you.
Thank you. She shouldn't have been, you shouldn't have lost track of her in the first place. But okay, so that's a given. So just want to put that out there that nobody has the right to take the life of an innocent person.
Full stop.
There we go. See, she was there all along.
It's so funny to me what makes you so happy.
Let me hear it again.
Full stop.
And the funny thing is that her...
He's smiling ear to ear, everyone. Oh, yeah. He loves it.
The funny thing is that that comes from a ridiculous... it wasn't an interview. She was testifying, I think, before Congress. And in her whole shebang that she presented was ridiculous, but that one thing was worth keeping. Let's hear her again.
Full stop.
Yeah. Okay, please keep her at the ready. You never know when we might need her services.
Yes, sir.
Thank you. See that you do it this time. Also, in a few minutes, we're going to take some phone calls. I want to get to a good article in the National Catholic Register on how you can debunk 7 common myths that are out there swirling around about overturning Roe versus Wade. There are a lot of false narratives out there, and the 7 of them are going to get the chop, and you're going to see how you can debunk them. So be sure to stay tuned for that. That's coming up in a minute. First, though, let's get to the phones. Let's go to Eagle River, Wisconsin, and talk to Lloyd. Hello, Lloyd. Welcome.
Good. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
We had a get-together, and we were watching The Chosen.
Mm-hmm.
And there was some discussion afterwards, which was pretty interesting. So I got 2 questions, if you could answer them. One
sure.
was about Mary and giving birth to Jesus.
Okay.
Was it a pain? And then was it a normal birth? And if it was a normal birth, how would she have been able to stay a true virgin?
Okay.
So we had a discussion on that, and some people were all over the place with it. I listened to you a couple times. I knew enough just to make myself dangerous, but I even told him, you know what, I'm going to give you a call and I'm going to find the truth. So that's, this is a journey that was on that I'm going to go back the next time we have one that I can try to explain it to them.
Sounds good. Well, I appreciate your confidence, Lloyd. Thank you. Well, this is one of those issues that has not been revealed to us in fine detail, and probably better that it not be. There's really no need for us to know any fine detail on this issue, except for what the church dogmatically teaches, which is that Mary was a virgin before, during, and after the birth of Jesus. Now, the during is the area where there's a question mark. We know that she did not have any marital relations before the conception of Jesus. That was a miracle, as the angel Gabriel told her, Luke chapter 1. We know that Mary did not have any marital relations after the birth of Jesus. So that is implicitly stated in Scripture. It's not explicit. It is implicitly stated. And it's also explicitly verified through apostolic tradition. And keep in mind that St. Paul said in 2 Thessalonians 2:15 that we are to stand firm and hold fast to the traditions we have received, either by an oral statement, that's apostolic tradition, if we want to, you know, reduce it to that, or by a letter of ours, that would be referring to Scripture. So we know that she was a virgin before the delivery. We know that she was a virgin after the delivery. So the church dogmatically says that she remained a virgin during the delivery. Now, what does that mean exactly? Because obviously there are certain structures in human physiology and anatomy that can tell you, one in particular, that can tell you whether or not a woman, at least assuming that other possibilities may not be in place, that she is a virgin. And so we don't know, because divine revelation has not told us anything about how, just that she did remain a virgin. So some of the church fathers, for example, who comment on this issue, now not all of them did, but those who did comment on this issue and they took up this question, one theory that was proposed was that it was a miraculous birth, like a ray of light passing through a pane of glass. It really does go through the glass. It really comes from one side of the glass through the other, but it does so in a way that doesn't break the glass. So that was one theory. Certainly God could have done it that way, because after all, the conception of Jesus in his mother's womb, that too was a miracle. So everything about this whole situation is miraculous in some sense. So there's nothing outlandish or far-fetched to say that maybe it was something like that, because if it were something like that, then it would mean that there was no change to these anatomical structures by which one can determine if a woman is likely a virgin or not. I don't think we need to say much more about that. But the main thing is, what about Mary as she seems to be described in Revelation chapter 12? Because there in Revelation chapter 12, beginning in verse 1, St. John says, "Then I beheld a great sign in the sky, a woman clothed with the sun, with a crown of stars on her head. She's standing on the moon." And we're told that this woman wailed aloud in pain as she labored to give birth to a male child who is destined to rule the nations. That male child, of course, as you read on, you see that's Jesus. And he's caught up to heaven. And the woman is put into a safe place because this red dragon is trying to devour her. So it's a very dramatic story. But if we're looking at the different senses of Scripture, you've got the anagogical sense, you've got the literal sense, etc. So if the literal sense here is referring to Jesus as the male child, well, literally, the mother of this male child is Mary, the Blessed Virgin Mary. Now, other layers of meaning can certainly apply. So the woman may also be symbolic of Israel and all the travails that Israel went through, and all the pain and all the suffering and the, you know, these scatterings to other parts of the earth. And yet, in the end, the Messiah is born of Israel. That, too, is a very likely meaning of this passage. But at the literal level, we know that it must mean Mary, because it's referring to Jesus. So that introduces now a question. Well, if the Bible seems to suggest that either literally or maybe in some symbolic way, that Our Lady labored in pain to give birth, and she was wailing, you know, as women often do. I've seen a lot of babies born, and I know that it's not uncommon for the pain to reach the point where the woman cries out. So what does that mean? Because after all, Mary was not subject to the penalties of original sin, which God explained as he pronounced them in Genesis chapter 3. One of the punishments for the fall of Adam and Eve was pain in childbirth. So since Mary was never in the state of sin, she was not tainted by the condition of original sin, she's not subject to that. But that leads to another possibility. Is it possible that just as Jesus, who is sinless and not subject to this penalty, that he died on the cross, he didn't have to die? Our Lady, technically speaking, although because she was never subject to original sin, she too, we could presume, would have immunity from illness and immortality, but we know that she died as well. So one theory that seems very plausible to me is that Our Lady willingly entered into a suffering that was not hers, because she did not have this penalty hanging over her head the way all of the rest of humanity does. That's possible. So at best, we can say we know that Mary was a perpetual virgin before, during, and after, but what the during part means exactly, we don't know. And it's not for us to know. And if it was something that we should know, God would have revealed it to us, but he didn't. So I think we can just take it on faith that she was, and maybe when we get to heaven, those things will be explained, maybe not. But that's the way I approach it, Lloyd. There's a little overview for you. What do you think?
No, thanks a lot. Like I said, there was a lot of confusion there with the different people that were there. They were back and forth about it. So, yeah, no, right. I appreciate you explaining. The other question, there was a gentleman there. Everybody there was a so-called Catholic. This guy calls himself a Catholic, but he's not. He doesn't say where he goes to church. You know what I mean? He doesn't come out and say, but so he's got to be a different right. And it didn't seem like he was all for the Vatican II.
What about it? I mean, I'm not trying to be flippant, but what about that?
Well, like he didn't recognize it. He like there was a flag that went up about the Vatican II. When it got changed over, like it should have stayed the same and not changed. Like they changed, you know what I mean?
I don't.
And
was it just
about the mass?
Are you asking me to comment on the fact that he was cryptic about his? I mean, what can I say? I don't know what to say about that.
No, well, I guess what I'm saying is he came out and talked about Ukraine, and he came out and talked about Russia, about Ukraine is Catholic, correct?
Largely Catholic, yes, largely Catholic. There is a great Orthodox presence there as well. But can you boil it down for me? I've got to take a break, Lloyd. Can you give it to me in a 30-second soundbite?
I guess that's what he was going off on. Some are Catholics and they're how they're intertwined or are meant together. So I would almost think they got to all believe into the Pope, correct? But he wasn't coming out saying what he was.
All right.
You know, is there different rights? You know what I'm saying?
I do and I don't. I'm not really sure what you're saying on that one. I'll have to take a rain check on that second question, Lloyd, but I hope we covered the first one sufficiently. Thank you. I really appreciate it. I'll be right back. Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening to my podcast. In today's crazy world, finding companies that align with your Catholic values is a challenge. Your choice of cell phone provider matters. Cyrus and I switched to Charity Mobile, and you should too. Enjoy excellent coverage on America's most reliable network while supporting a pro-life, pro-family company. Use offer code Patrick for a free phone. Don't miss out. Act now at charitymobile.com. Notre Dame Federal Credit Union is a member of the Catholic Credit Unions of America. You can find more information and your local Catholic Credit Union at relevantradio.com/banking.
Real life solutions you can believe in. This is the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
All right, so check it out. There's this article. How do you like that Taco Tuesday music? An article by Jonah McKeon. No, that's true. Yes, that's true. Jonah McKeon, I don't know how he pronounces it, but it's in the Register. 7 common myths about overturning Roe versus Wade that you can debunk. Myth number 1. Abortion is now illegal in the United States. Abortion, he says, which the Catholic Church teaches as a grave evil, is still legal in many parts of the country. Now that Roe versus Wade is overturned. Let me say that again. Now that Roe versus Wade is overturned. Cyrus. Cyrus, come on, man. You got to spin it up. Get up to speed here.
Come on, man.
Let me start over. Now that Roe versus Wade is overturned. Now that Roe versus Wade is overturned. Thank you. Abortion will be governed by the state. All right. Abortion will be, this is not a funny topic, so I want to be serious. Abortion will be governed by state laws, and for years, some states have been legislating in a pro-life direction and others in a pro-choice direction. States such as Hawaii, Colorado, Nevada, New York, and Illinois have written explicit abortion protections into their state laws. Abortions there will continue, and many of those states have positioned themselves as destinations for women traveling to obtain abortions from states with more restrictions. There exist dozens of state laws regulating abortion that were, up until the court's June 24th ruling, in legal limbo or struck down entirely for being out of step with Roe and thus unconstitutional. Now, those laws will be able to come into effect. They include a total ban on abortions in these states: Arkansas, Idaho, Kentucky, Louisiana, Mississippi, Missouri, North Dakota, South Dakota, Tennessee, Utah, Texas, Oklahoma, and Wyoming. The legal landscape at the state level is varied and complex, as among the more pro-life states, there are a variety of kinds of restrictions that have been enacted. For example, Nebraska bans a certain kind of abortion called dilation and evacuation, D&E, which is typically done in the second trimester of pregnancy and results in the dismemberment of an unborn child. Other states, such as Arizona, have restrictions such as a ban on abortions done solely because of a Down syndrome diagnosis. A handful of states, such as Michigan, have previously unenforceable bans on abortions, some 100 or more years old, that have never been repealed. In Michigan, where a judge recently blocked the state's ban, Governor Gretchen Whitmer, a Democrat, has repeatedly called for the ban's complete repeal. Some state legislatures may scramble in the coming days, weeks, and months to pass laws regulating or deregulating abortion. Myth number two, women will be harmed by this decision. Virtually all states with trigger laws to ban abortion include an exception for medical emergencies and stipulate that the person punished under the law would be the person performing the abortion, not the woman seeking one. In addition, at least one expert observer says cases of women being prosecuted for obtaining abortions are very likely to occur. There is no documented case in America of a woman being prosecuted for seeking an abortion since 1922, 100 years ago. There has been only one case of a woman being convicted for unlawful self-management of abortion, and that was vacated on appeal. All modern abortion laws immunize the woman seeking abortion from liability. Speaking more broadly, there is a commonly cited study called the Turnaway Study, which advocates of abortion say proves that most women do not regret their abortion and that women who were denied abortions at certain points in their lives had worse mental health and economic outcomes than those who were not. The study has since been widely debunked, with its research methods and potential conflicts of interest being criticized. Many women who regret their abortions have joined the pro-life movement. Myth number three. Women could now be jailed after having miscarriages. The answer is about one in five pregnancies will end in miscarriage. Every woman will respond and process her grief differently. But needless to say, such an intensely personal and emotional occurrence should be met with compassion and loving care, not criminal proceedings. This is an extremely sensitive topic for many women. Some pro-choice advocates have pointed to countries such as El Salvador, where abortion is banned entirely and women have been arrested after miscarriages and investigated, as portending what could happen in the United States. But incidents in the U.S. where a mother could be jailed for a miscarriage are relatively rare and often involve instances where women used illegal and harmful drugs during pregnancy. In Oklahoma, a woman who was sentenced last October to 4 years in prison after her baby died in the womb at 17 weeks. In that case, the 21-year-old woman admitted to using methamphetamines while pregnant, and traces of meth were found in the unborn baby's body. About two dozen states have laws defining substance use during pregnancy as child abuse under civil child welfare statutes, according to the pro-abortion Guttmacher Institute. But there is also no serious likelihood of the incidental criminalization of contraception, in vitro fertilization, and management of ectopic pregnancies or miscarriages. Now, this is referring here to a legal scholar who was cited in the article earlier. The next myth, a majority of women will live in states with no surgical abortion. The answer is because several of the most populous states in the nation, such as California and New York and Illinois, have moved to codify abortion into their laws. A majority of women will likely live in states where surgical abortion is still accessible. Many of the most pro-life states in the country have relatively small populations, despite being geographically large. Also, populous states, such as Texas and Florida, have made moves toward more pro-life policies in recent years. The next myth, treatment for ectopic pregnancy is considered an abortion, and thus many women will die from lack of treatment in states where abortion is illegal. Answer, ectopic pregnancies occur when an embryo implants outside the uterus, usually in the fallopian tube. Although relatively rare, the most recent data available from the CDC, shows the rate of ectopic pregnancies increasing to about 1.4% as of 2013 and could be as high as 2%. Once implanted, the embryo's growth is likely to rupture the fallopian tube, which can cause the death of both the mother and the child. And whether treatment is done or not, the embryo is highly unlikely to survive. There are three common medical procedures to address ectopic pregnancies, two surgical and one involving a drug. In all these procedures, the embryo dies. From a Catholic perspective, direct abortion, which is the intentional killing of an unborn baby, is never permitted, but a procedure to save a woman's life that has the unintended effect of an unborn baby's death is morally permissible. But medical professionals have noted that virtually every state regulation or ban on abortion contains an explicit exception for ectopic pregnancy treatment, which again is generally not considered the same as an abortion. True, some recent state legislative proposals have garnered frenzied media attention and have included references to ectopic pregnancy that have worried some medical professionals because of the ambiguity. But state legislatures have taken steps to address this issue and make sure that ectopic pregnancy treatments are allowed and accessible. For example, a Louisiana bill under consideration would treat abortion as a homicide and originally did not carve out an explicit protection for ectopic pregnancy treatment. However, a companion bill in Louisiana from a pro-life Democrat explicitly states that ectopic pregnancy treatments are not illegal under Louisiana's abortion ban. The next myth. Women in states where surgical abortions are banned will be unable to get abortions unless they travel. The reality is that abortion will remain accessible for many women who seek it out. Part of the reason for this is the proliferation of the so-called abortion pill, also known as a medication abortion. According to the U.S. Centers for Disease Control's most recent abortion surveillance report for the year 2019, early medical abortions made up 42% of abortions that year. And that's a reference to the medical abortion, not a surgical abortion. The two-pill regimen is fully approved by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, which in late 2021 authorized doctors to prescribe the drugs online and mail the pills, allowing women to perform early abortions up to 10 weeks of gestation without leaving their homes. This whole thing is terribly sad. The last 19 states mandate that a clinician must be physically present when the pills are administered, but even so, research by pro-life groups has found that the rate of abortion-related emergency room visits is increasing faster for medical abortions than for surgical abortions. You see what that means? So if you, not that you would do this because you're a good person, but if some woman were to get the pills through the mail and do the do-it-yourself version using this medication, it's saying here that this research shows that the number of visits to the emergency room, because the woman's life is now in danger as a result of this attempt at an abortion, it's increasing faster for those who take the medical version, the pills, than for those who have problems in the abortion center when there's a surgical abortion being performed. So the moral to that story is that medical abortion, getting the pills through the mail and doing it that way, seems to be becoming more dangerous. To complicate matters, taking an abortion pill can cause a life-threatening emergency for women who have an ectopic pregnancy. And telehealth appointments may not be enough to catch when a woman seeking a medication abortion is experiencing an ectopic pregnancy. And the last myth, now that Roe v. Wade is overturned, it's a done deal. States will always be able to restrict abortion from now on. This is true currently, but the federal government under President Joe Biden, a Catholic, by the way, has attempted to pass a bill codifying Roe v. Wade into federal law, which, if passed, would supersede state-level pro-life laws, but such attempts so far have failed. But just because such efforts have failed so far doesn't mean that the federal government will not continue to try to pass such measures. There is a chance, however, that in light of the Dobbs ruling, the Supreme Court could strike down a federal law attempting to codify abortion rights. So, helpful, if you ask me, and that's available to you if you want to go to the show Twitter feed at P Madrid Show. You can access it there. You can also get it on the show page, relevantradio.com/Patrick. Let's go to Joe now in Minneapolis. Good morning, Joe.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my phone call. I wanted to ask you about the Dudikay.
Okay.
I've heard you talk about it before, but I don't know what it is. And a couple of questions I have regarding, there is something, I guess, that says in there about abortion directly. And also, is it a document that is accepted by Protestants as well? And can I read it somewhere?
Yes. Okay, so let's take them in order. So the Didache is an early second century document from Syria, as I understand it. And it is a synopsis, you might say, of apostolic teaching on many issues. It doesn't it doesn't purport to be exhaustive or encyclopedic, but it is a rather broad overview of many of the apostolic teachings. And it does, for example, also shed light on what was worship like in the early church. You know, what was the Mass like when they were going to Mass? So that's what it is. Can you read it online? Yes. It's easily available in English. All you have to do is type in the Didache, or just Didache, D-I-D-A-C-H-E. That's referring to the teaching of the 12 apostles. And it doesn't have an author, you know, specifically. So it's not like somebody wrote that under his own name, but it's, as I say, a synopsis of teaching. Now, do Protestants accept it? Well, not in any significant way. I mean, any more so than they might be willing to look at any other patristic era writings. Most Protestants, they would say that those are interesting, but they're not authoritative, and they're not really that important in the bigger picture. All that's really ultimately important is Scripture alone. That's one of the errors of the Protestant Reformation. The Bible itself doesn't even teach that. But to whatever extent a given Protestant might be interested in the early church, he might read it or consult it. But by and large, Protestants generally ignore the early church documents. They ignore the church fathers, and the Didache being an earlier version. Now, one reason why they tend to ignore it, I have found, is in my experience, when Protestants begin to read the early Christian literature, they say, uh-oh, wait a minute, those people were Catholic. And they realize that this fanciful notion that they've been fed over the years, that somehow the early church was just like a bunch of Bible Christians getting together for Bible studies, and that they didn't have the Mass, or they didn't do or believe those things that the Catholic Church does. And they realize that's just a fanciful notion. It presents them with a fork in the road. They either have to go where the evidence leads, which is to the Catholic Church, or they have to ignore the evidence and persist in this notion that non-denominational Bible-only Christianity was what the early church was when it really wasn't. And that's where the Didache, quite frankly, has a lot of value, because when you read it, you see that this is not something that corresponds with Calvary Chapel or Good Book Baptist or any of those ways of expressing Protestant Christianity. It's something very Catholic. And the reason, of course, is because the early church was Catholic with a capital C. So there you go.
That sounds great. I'm going to research it now and see if I can find it. So thank you so much. I really appreciate it, and I appreciate everything that you do.
Oh, you're very kind. I appreciate that. Before you go, I'll just mention one resource that you might find helpful. There is a book called The Four Witnesses, and that's by Rod Bennett, published by Ignatius Press. And the Didache is one of those documents that's there. There are three others, the Epistle of St. Clement to the Corinthians, the Didache, I believe the Shepherd of Hermas is there, and maybe something from Papias. I'd have to go back and relook at it, but there's a fourth one. And so this book contains all of these early Christian documents in their entirety and commentary to help you as you read through them to understand what it's referring to. So that might be something to take a look at. But
where
you can
am I
read
supposed
it,
to get it?
Your local Catholic bookstore. You can get the Didache electronically online, though. Glad I can be of service, Joe. Thank you. How about Howard now in Eagle, Wisconsin? Good morning, Howard.
Good morning. I have a, thank you for taking my call, by the way.
Sure.
I have a question. I was reading and hearing a story about the angels picking up Mary's original birth home and moving it away because of the Muslims at the time were invading. And I'm wondering if there's some truth to that story.
Yeah, I think you're thinking of what's known as the Holy House of Loreto, and it's called that
because it's
in Loreto,
yes.
Italy. Okay.
Yes.
Well, I mean, it seems to have the pedigree of miraculousness, if that's a word. And I'm not deeply steeped in the information about it, but I mean, this is a long-standing tradition that the angels carried this house to Italy. And yes, it seems as though it was in the 13th century, and it was done to preserve it from being destroyed by Muslims. So that's the story behind it. Now, there's plenty written about it. If you Google it, you'll be able to find quite a bit available about that. But As far as I can tell, I mean, there's a lot there that would suggest that the story may be authentic. I just don't know with certitude. I don't think the church says with any certitude that it is, but it's kind of like the Shroud of Turin. I mean, there's a lot about it that seems to point in that direction.
Well, I received the email, naturally, from a non-Catholic, and I don't know if it was a point when we get together the next time for some discussion or trying embarrassment to me being a Catholic and they being a non-Catholic. So I thought I'd call my architecture of learning.
Okay. That sounds good. I'm glad we can be of service here on Relevant Radio.
Appreciate it. Thank you so very much.
Thank you, Howard. How about Bill now in Buffalo? Good morning, Bill.
Good morning, Patrick. I wanted to ask you, in general, is purgatory something that is only for Catholics, or is it for everybody? And I was thinking of this because of the reaction to when Roe versus Wade was just overturned and the apoplectic reactions of some of these other people. So for these three examples, someone that thinks that, well, if I'm a good person, I'll get to heaven, and I'm just protecting what they think is women's rights in this case. Or if you have another person that's like a non-Catholic who says, I believe that once saved, always saved, and I'm just going to commit sin because Jesus saved me. Or in the last extreme case, someone that thinks like, well, if I'm a suicide bomber and I do this against the infidels, I'm going to be rewarded. So will those people see purgatory?
No, chances are, and of course, those are different disparate groups. But really what it boils down to, Bill, is if you die in the state of grace. So if you die in the state of grace and there's still need for purification of your soul before you see God face to face, because remember, it says in Revelation 21, 27, nothing unclean will be allowed to go into heaven. Jesus said in the Sermon on the Mount, he says, blessed are the pure of heart, for they shall see God. So we can reason our way to the conclusion that if you're not pure of heart, you're not going to see God. So if you die in the state of grace and yet you're not entirely purified, that will take place in purgatory. Anyone else, if they die in the state of mortal sin, that's it. They go to hell by their own choice, of course. So maybe the best way to answer your question, Bill, is that it seems that it would be very difficult to die in the state of grace if you were not a Catholic. Unless, in your final moments, you had this intense desire to love God and to be sorry for your sins, and in a way that might be known only to God, that translated into, or maybe that's not the right way to put it, that in effect was a desire to be Catholic, a desire to be in the church that Christ established, even if the person maybe didn't necessarily understand it in this life. At the very end of life, it's certainly possible that somebody could have that kind of desire and love in response to God's grace and thus die in the state of grace. But all other things being equal, the Catholic Church says, and if you want to read the specifics, go to Lumen Gentium, the document of Vatican II, and read section 14. You can read it online if you want, but it says there, and I'm paraphrasing, that anybody who refuses to enter or to remain in the Catholic Church, knowing that it was necessary for salvation, that person could not be saved. So it suggests to me that the likelihood of somebody remaining outside the Catholic Church and dying in the state of grace seems a lot less likely. Only God knows. But Jesus said that the road to perdition is wide and well-traveled, and the gate that leads to eternal life is narrow, and few find it, he said. So he said, strive to enter by the narrow gate. I suppose we should really look closely at what Jesus said there. If he seems to suggest that many people are going to hell and fewer people are going to heaven, that seems to support the idea that it's a lot less likely that you could die in the state of grace and not be Catholic. But only God knows. We just do the best we can. I'll be right back. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio Line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/forester.
Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Have a question? Give Patrick a call. 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid on Relevant Radio.
Oh. I guess it's technically Taco Tuesday.
You still know the dance, I see. Nice.
Well, you can't help but tapping your toes when this song comes on, right? Oh, well. All right. By the way, I don't know if you... Cyrus, you're not thinking about going into the military, are you?
They wouldn't have me.
At your age, probably not. But then again, well, check it out. NBC News has a very interesting article about how every branch of the U.S. military right now is struggling to meet its recruiting goals, every single one. And the article actually gives some statistics on the Marines, the Air Force, the Army, etc. Among Americans surveyed by the Pentagon who are in the target age range for recruiting, only 13% had parents who served in the military, which is down from 40% in 1995. The military considers parents who have served in the military as one of the biggest influencers on the service. An expert on military personnel policy says middle-class parents, including those who are newly middle-class, often encourage their kids to go to college before selecting a career, which hurts recruiting for enlisted personnel. Changing the mind of parents is the really tough part, particularly if these parents who worked really hard for their children to go to college, according to the Center for New American Security. That's why they're trying to win the hearts and the minds, they being the military recruiters. Overall, confidence in U.S. government institutions is also decreasing. That has hit the military as well. In the 2021 annual Reagan National Defense Survey, conducted by the Ronald Reagan Presidential Foundation and Institute, it found that just 45% of Americans had a great deal of trust and confidence in the military, down 25 points since 2018. The trend will most likely continue as the overall military shrinks and familiarity with service keeps dropping. In 2021, an Army study found that 75% of Americans ages 16 to 28 knew little to nothing about the Army. You know, I'll tell you why. It's because no one reads anymore. No one's reading history books. No one's reading stories like about World War II, the Civil War. You know, not to glorify war, but to acquaint people with the reality of war and the reality of military service. The Air Force has to recruit roughly 100 times as many airmen, about 50,000, compared to the newly formed Space Force. They're currently more than 4,000 below where they should be at this point in the year. The Army has only met about 40% of its recruiting mission for fiscal year 2022, so it's way down. Navy officials, as you might imagine, they're pretty excited about the new Top Gun Maverick movie. They say that is likely to attract recruits. And all of them are going to be knocking on the Navy's door saying, I want to fly airplanes. And they're not all going to be able to do that, obviously. The Marine Corps similarly dampened in its efforts to recruit. The Coast Guard is lagging behind its active duty numbers for the year. It has met 80% and 93% of its goals for reserves and officers, respectively. But it's only filled 55%. Of its target for active duty enlistments. Now, that's coupled with another story, and this has to do with the way in which the military is changing, I would say sort of downgrading its requirements for enlistment. And that includes such things as allowing people who have tattoos, which previously were not permitted, at least generally speaking, they were not permitted. But soldiers now, according to Stripes.com, a military outfit, soldiers can now have tattoos on their hands, behind their ears, and on the back of their necks, according to an updated Army tattoo policy published last week. Army officials say the new policy will better align the service with social norms on tattoos and make enlistment processes simpler for recruits. Tattoos in some of these areas on the body were previously banned. Major General Doug Stitt, the Army's Director of Military Personnel Management, says, we always review policy to keep the Army as an open option to as many people as possible who want to serve. This directive makes sense for currently serving soldiers and allows a greater number of talented individuals the opportunity to serve now. And there are a few other things that they are relaxing. But this is an interesting sign of the times. Cyrus, you know those robot dogs that Boston Dynamics has, the really scary videos of these robot dogs that can go anywhere and do anything. Why don't we just build like hundreds of thousands of those and mount machine guns or lasers to them and send them into battle?
Maybe because of remember the story you read just a couple of days ago or reported about AI being self-aware? Yeah.
Oh, I get it, because they might turn on us.
There you go.
Huh. Boy, you know, we're it's like a checkmate. AI has us in checkmate. Now, I wonder if the burger flippers would turn on their human overlords.
I don't want to think about it. Let's leave that to the movies. Those robot dogs are frightening.
They're downright scary. Yeah, if they had, could you imagine being like a Russian soldier? Or I mean, they can't even get their act together over there in Ukraine right now. But imagine if you're a Russian soldier and you see an army of robot dogs advancing on your position. Probably gonna.
Yeah, that's not going to end well.
Yeah. Now, one final thing for your good to know file, then we'll move back to phone calls. NATO, this according to Sky News, is dramatically increasing its presence in Europe. It has gone from 40,000 only months ago, and we have ramped up, we being the NATO countries, and a lot of it is us, the U.S., have ramped up to 300,000 troops now in Europe. And they're saying that, we're not going to go to war with Russia, but we're going to build up this massive military presence there just in case. And if you're interested in reading the specifics on this, including like, you know, where these forces being stationed, what are they being poised to do? It sure looks to me like things are being put in place for a conflict with Russia in Europe. I sure hope that that doesn't happen. I mean, that's putting it lightly. But if you're interested in this, especially if you have a son or daughter serving in the military in the European theater, take a look at this. A lot of forces from the U.S., it appears, are being deployed or redeployed over in that area. All the more reason to pray for peace, don't you think? 888-914-9149. Let's go back to the phones. Let's go to Mike in northern Wisconsin. Hello, Mike.
Hello, Patrick.
Hello, Mike.
I've got a question. I'm up at the lake enjoying the some nice weather and maybe some fishing. But anyway, I got a question. Our parish, I live in New Berlin in the Milwaukee area, but our parish has definitely a progressive priest. And about half the time I have to, I leave Mass and I go, well, that's not right.
Yeah.
But this past Sunday, he used the opportunity of the gospel to talk about comparing about mercy of God and attaining heaven as a gift and not focusing on what we do or our behavior. But he made a statement that back in the late 90s, we agreed that the Protestants had it right all along, and you can attain heaven just by the grace of God and as a gift from God. I thought, that's not right. I thought we agreed that, yeah, it is a gift, but your behavior is still going to come into play at your exit interview, as you always say, which I like.
Yeah. Well, I mean, not having heard it myself, I'll just go by what you said, and I trust you. I mean, I believe you. What you're saying is true. But the thing is that the Bible is really clear in Ephesians 2, verses 8 through 9. It says, for by grace you have been saved through faith. This is a gift of God. This is not of works, lest anyone should boast. So the authentic Catholic teaching always has been, and the Council of Trent enunciated this again, and that is that there's nothing that you or I can do to earn our salvation. In fact, the Council of Trent reiterated its condemnation of that view. In the early church at the time of St. Augustine, one version of that was known as Pelagianism. There was an English monk named Pelagius who was writing that basically God will save you after all that you can do to save yourself, and then God sort of kicks in whatever might be missing. But essentially, it's the heresy that we as human beings have the native ability, that we have a natural capacity to save ourselves. And the answer to that, as St. Augustine said, because he shut him down really hard, St. Augustine said, well, of course we don't have a natural capacity to do that, because if we did, then the incarnation of Christ would be superfluous. There'd be no reason for the second person of the Trinity to become a human being and to save us. If we could do it for ourselves, all of that becomes superfluous. So the church's age-old teaching from St. Paul forward is that we are saved by grace. You're definitely not saved by faith alone. You're definitely not saved by works alone. And you're really not even saved by faith and works together. You're saved by grace. And so if the priest was trying to enunciate that, he was correct. But it would be, I think, very misleading, very incorrect to say, well, the Protestants had it right all along. Well, first of all, which Protestant? Because they don't agree among themselves. Martin Luther, John Calvin, Erl Zwingli, the three major branches of the nascent Protestant rebellion, the Lutheran, the Calvinist, and the Anabaptist branches, they don't agree among themselves on major aspects of this. So if he's saying, well, Protestants had it right all along, I would say, okay, which Protestants do you have in mind? Do you mean Martin Luther? Well, no, Martin Luther didn't have it right, number one, because he advanced a novel theory of justification by faith alone. Justification is where you're put into a right relationship with God. And that amounts to, it's tantamount to, the heresy of saying that you're saved by faith alone, which you're not. So maybe what he was trying to say in a muddled sort of way was that, yes, the church has always championed this biblical principle that we're saved by grace alone, and we appropriate that grace through faith, but it also is lived out through good works. And all of those things, both the faith and the good works, those are, as it says in Ephesians 2, those are gifts from God. So we can't even take credit for that. We do them because God enables us to do them, but it's not something that we can do on our own apart from God's grace. I wish I had more time, Mark, but I hope that gives you a little more to go on. I appreciate your phone call. Have fun fishing. Sounds like an idyllic time up there. I'll be right back with hour two right after this.